Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we are catching up with Matt Tate. Matt is better known by his handle Pwn All The Things on Twitter, and he is joining us this week to talk about the claims various sources have made against Kaspersky. Now, I say sources because until this point, the only thing we've seen is various officials saying people shouldn't use it. There's been no official statement from the US government or the intelligence community that actually says don't use it. And the situation is getting kind of ridiculous. It's as clear as mud right now, basically. So Matt will be along later on to argue the US government really just needs to back the claims that it's made indirectly, but in an official way, if they are to be taken seriously. This week's show is brought to you by Silence. First up, I want to assure you that the timing of Silence's sponsorship this week is a coincidence. We don't schedule these interviews to coincide with digs at the competition. It just worked out that way this week. We actually book our interviews for the weekly show, like sometimes it's like up to 18 months out. So I can tell you, for example, that Duo Security is sponsoring episode 523 on November 21st, 2018. So there you go. It is a coincidence. But this week we are chatting with Chris Coulter, a seasoned incident response professional who's recently moved from the services side of Silence to the product side. We'll be talking to Chris about incident response and where EDR, Endpoint Detection and Response software, where that's going. That one is really worth listening to. It's easy to look at Silence today and see just another antivirus company, but people have forgotten that they really shook up the biggest market in InfoSec when they first launched, and I think they have a solid chance of doing the same thing with a few of their upcoming releases in the EDR and maybe the UBA space. Check out that sponsor interview with Chris Coulter towards the back of the show. But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, first up, they are calling it Bad Rabbit, the Bad Rabbit ransomware, and it is a bad, bad bunny indeed.
Yeah, there's reports coming in from Russia and Ukraine and kind of related places in the world of another piece of ransomware during the rounds, one that looks rather similar to the NotPetya one, which we saw in the Ukraine recently. It does the same basic sorts of things, gets on your box by means that are a little bit vague at the moment, and then cryptos your files. It does appear to have some SMB-based lateral movement technique, drops Mimikatz, steals some creds, moves around your network via file shares. Contrary to previous reports, apparently it doesn't include Eternal Blue, but no one seems really sure what the initial delivery vector other than local LAN spreading is, and it does seem to have popped up in a bunch of places around Russia and Ukraine. So interesting.
Well, I mean, when we saw what NotPetya did, you know, like it was spreading via SMB shares using an exploit, but replacing that with Mimikatz just makes total sense. I mean, it still gets you basically the same thing, right?
Yeah, it's certainly more reliable than an exploit, but I guess the question is, what relationship does this have to the previous code? I mean, some of the research, some people have been looking at it, say that it does have some code sharing with NotPetya, although it's not clear whether that's just like it has Mimikatz in it, and that makes for some commonality, like whether it's components that are shared or whether there's actual, you know, core things that are shared. But yeah, it's
The time we sit down next week, we're going to be able to read reams and reams of e-paper on this one.
Yeah, it's, you know, kind of remains to be seen like how much impact it's going to have. No one also seems clear whether or not paying money gets your data back.
I think the last I saw on Twitter was someone was watching the Bitcoin wallets and nothing had been paid, which made me think not that people aren't paying, but maybe it's broken.
Yeah, or maybe there's a little bit of ransomware fatigue. I don't know. Maybe people have great backups these days and don't need to pay.
As I understand, this one is having a big impact, not quite like NotPetya, which, you know, the effects of that are still being felt through, you know, global logistics, but not quite that bad. But it does seem like this is a pretty bad one.
Yeah, although I guess we will see. I mean, the story has only just broken in the last couple of days. So, we'll have to wait and see whether or not it turns into a big one.
Now, of course, last year we were all terribly worried about the Mirai botnet. It looks like that one is now being superseded by a botnet named either Reaper or IO Troop. What do we know about this one?
So it looks like Checkpoint has been tracking the rise of this Internet of Things botnet. It has some similarity to Mirai in that it targets Internet of Things, and it's been doing the rounds and building itself up into a, you know, what looks like quite a large botnet. There are Checkpoint has been tracking a number, I think, into the millions of compromised systems. But it's using known bugs in a bunch of different vendors' IoT products to propagate, and then not doing anything except propagating at the moment. And so Krebs is running a piece kind of speculating as to what sort of things it might be used for. Obviously, it could be used for DDoS in the way that we saw Mirai, but there's a lot of other things you could do with a compromised Internet of Things botnet that may be more interesting than denial of service. But we've seen this in the past, I guess, botnets that spread but never got used. I'm thinking specifically Conficker. But if we're talking a botnet that is bigger than Mirai was, and we saw the level of damage that did in terms of number of packets per second. I mean, anything that scared Krebs, scared Akamai away from hosting Krebs' site, I guess must have been pretty big. What was it, 600 gigabits, one of that? So it has some potential, but it remains to be seen what the operators are going to do with it, if anything.
Yeah, we will have to wait on that. But I'm thinking it's just an excellent sales opportunity for people who sell infrastructure gear to CDNs. So fire up those phones, sales droids. Cisco Talos has uncovered a pretty decent campaign, which is actually targeting people who are attending the Cyber Conflict US conference. It's called CyCon. And what's really funny about this is people in InfoSec are always like, oh, look, I got targeted. Oh, the conference I'm going to got targeted. I've seen multiple people who are speaking at that conference tweeting about how, the Russians are attacking the conference they're speaking at. Everyone feels a little bit special when they're sort of tied to some state-backed activity, right? But this does look interesting.
Yeah, so it's interesting for two reasons. One, I guess, is that the Lua document targets this particular conference. Second is that it looks like it's Fancy Bear. The Russians. And I suppose the third thing is that instead of dropping malware, it just has a Visual Basic payload and a Word doc. You may be being targeted, people going to this conference, but you're not getting the good stuff. Getting rubbish throwaway macros.
What I'm interested in, though, is how they've got the targeting lists for this. Is there any word on that?
Talos doesn't appear to have any information about how the targeting list was acquired and or indeed whether it was well targeted or relatively broad. So, good question. I don't know.
Kim Zetta, formerly of Wired, has her byline has popped up at The Intercept, and she's got an interesting take on these Kaspersky Lab claims. This week's feature interview, of course, is with Matt Tate. And we'll be talking about this a little bit, but it's there are really two competing narratives when it comes to what Kaspersky's actually accused of there, and I think that's interesting because both of them are plausible.
Yeah, I mean, the story kind of breaks down some of the functionality of modern antivirus in terms of signatures that vendors are very confident about that pop up warnings and say it's this virus, and ones that they're not. That they're still kind of researching, which don't necessarily alert the user, but may in fact still trigger collection or quarantine or something like that. And the assertion is, I guess, in this story that, that's just what your AV product is doing. And that's one of the reasons that Kaspersky is good at this is because they go out and proactively hunt for APTs. And you would expect them to find nation state attackers if they're any good. And clearly they have found a bunch over the years. So I guess this side of the narrative is that this is just Kaspersky doing what they should, and that probably they weren't looking for top secret. They were just looking for what looked like nation state malware, and that, of course, hoovered up NSA tools. And then either Kaspersky's cooperating with the Russians or the Russians own Kaspersky, like the Israelis and presumably lots of other people have, and helped themselves. And I guess that bit's we don't really know.
We'll be exploring that a little bit more in this week's feature. But certainly if, I was a researcher with Symantec and I just uncovered a trove of tooling from a Chinese APT crew, I'm going to make some signatures and I'm probably going to share that information with the NSA because, that's just what happens these days, right?
So if that narrative is
what's actually happened here, then you could argue that Kaspersky hasn't done anything really wrong except unmask NSA malware, NSA working as an APT crew, you can think of it that way. But of course the allegations run a little bit deeper than that. We'll be breaking down those narratives a little bit later on. Staying on the Kaspersky thing though, there's a bit of political pushback too on the Department of Homeland Security in the United States. The DHS ordered, used a very rare type of order too, government administrators to get Kaspersky off government systems, but they've been given 90 days to comply. And now there's some desk pounding from a senator saying that's too long.
Which, yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny because, I mean, yes, clearly, if it's being used this way, then you do want it off your systems. But on the other hand, at what cost? Like, what? Why are you running antivirus in the first place? Well, to stop you getting owned by rubbish stuff.
Yeah. 90 days feels pretty good to me, man. I've got to say.
Yeah, like, I mean, to ask the government to do anything in 90 days, like, that's pretty good, right? I mean, imagine how much change control is involved in all of that and how many machines on a scale. Like, that doesn't seem like an unreasonable time frame to me. But, yeah, I guess it does boil down to how many things were people relying on antivirus to protect them from, and if you tell them to take it away, then what? What does that mean to your risk ratings and all that kind of thing? And I can imagine a lot of people are hand-wringing over that as well, which...
I mean, it just depends on the type of data they're holding, right? I mean, you know, first of all, you know, anything top secret shouldn't, you know, cloud AV shouldn't be a problem for that because it should all be air-gapped. But, you know, as we know, it doesn't quite work that way. But, you know, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, you know, can probably get away with its 90 days, you would think.
You would think, yeah. No, it's certainly not as straightforward, I think, as you know, one size fits all.
Yeah, that's right. Now, this story did break before we recorded last week's news segment, but it didn't make it in just basically because of space. But there's been an absolutely massive data leak in South Africa. And what's really interesting is now, you know, 1 week later, we've actually been able to trace the origin of this leak back to a real estate agency in Pretoria. That's what just makes my mind boggle about this story. Tens of millions of South Africans have had like their ID numbers and like full docs basically leaked, and Troy Hunt has it all on a disc somewhere.
Yeah, apparently the number is now something like, what, 60 or 70 million people's worth of data. And it's been interesting watching this story unfold because on one hand, clearly it's bad, right? I mean, I guess I'm not sure what the impact of having your ID number leaked in South Africa is. I don't have the local context, but it kind of...
Well, it's like a social security number, but in South Africa, right? Think of it like that.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess I'm not sure about that part of the impact, but the thing I thought was interesting is... You know, A, people realizing that once data has been lost, it's like you can't fix that. Doesn't matter how much you find them or who did it or why. It's lost. That's just the way it is. And then I think the second thing is this sort of idea that having that data is unusual or special. I mean, there was some of the South African coverage has been like, how do these people who are just a real estate agent, you know, how are they entrusted with this data? It's not. They just bought it from a, you know, data broker from a credit agency or something. And like, everybody has this kind of data. Like, it's amazing it doesn't leak more often.
They just left it lying around basically in a publicly accessible directory. So they published it to the internet. But SensePost took a poke around their website and it was just full of trivial SQLI as well, right? So there you go. They're just coming to grips with that at the moment. Pretty big deal over there. This story is actually kind of a nothing burger, but it's what I would describe as a close shave. APNIC, which is the Asia Pacific Network Information Center, accidentally published a whole bunch of password hashes, but they weren't like account password hashes. These were password hashes that, like, if you reverse them, you would be able to change like historical IP information or something. But still, like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, obviously it's pretty dumb. I mean, you don't want something as important as APNIC leaking password hashes for Whois data or whatever it was. But the thing that I feel makes this more interesting, I guess, is the sorts of people who set up those accounts, right? I mean, and these are accounts for ownership of IP blocks in Asia Pacific. Like, A, those credentials don't change very often, other than, you know, now when they've been leaked. And B, that's the sort of credential that is like used by an old school networks guy that registered the IP box 15 years ago. And it's the sort of person who uses the same password for everything.
Exactly.
So password reuse from this data set, man, I reckon would be a really useful thing. And if anyone has that data set, I would love it because I'm sure it would be coming handy for work. I would like that data set. I think it's underrated.
Some moderately interesting research has been published about attacks against FIPS certified devices. And what's cool about this is they've basically figured out that because there's some hard-coded seed data and a weak RNG, that you can take the two of them and it's predictable enough to make like cracking VPN traffic trivial. This is cool work, right? It just shows it's like crypto bug chaining.
Yeah, no, it is. It's cool research. Obviously, following on the heels of last week's crypto news, it's much less exciting. And I think, you know, Matthew Green and friends who've done this work might feel that they've been rather eclipsed by the previous week's crypto stuff. But yeah, it's good. You know, it's solid research to take, you know, a theoretical attack that we've known about in the 90s in this particular case, you know, for the RNG in question, and actually go through the process of implementing VPN traffic decrypt. I think in this case, they had that working against one of the Fortinet VPN products. But I think the other side of the story that's interesting is, given how kind of stupid this was, how was this in the FIPS standards for so many years without it being, without anyone going, actually, this is kind of bad? Like what use is having that kind of standards when this sort of stuff is in it? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, look, I don't think we can throw away FIPS certification, you know? Like, it is actually, because some of the stuff, you can imagine the stuff that they turn down, right?
Well, I can. I've seen a lot of rubbish crypto, yes. I can
look at it that way. Like, FIPS, you got to look at it as you must be this high to enter, you know? And I know that this is pretty bad, but yeah, I don't think we should apply this to, I don't think we should be leaving listeners with the impression that we don't think FIPS is, you know, kind of a good thing. There's a new OWASP top 10 coming, which, you know, they've actually meaningfully updated it, which is interesting.
Yeah, no, it is always good to see updates. I mean, OWASP top 10 is, it is only a list of 10. Obviously, there's things that don't make the cut that do need to be talked about, but it's a really good list for web developers to at least get their heads around, and I do support the idea. This new update has a few new things in it. They've included the XML external entity attacks, which is good to see, because that's a thing that I know I've used a lot in web app jobs to arb file read and onwards from there. They've introduced insecure deserialization, which of course has been responsible for a lot of relatively high profile things getting known. I'm thinking of Apache Struts, all of the Java deserialization, PHP object deserialization. So it's good to see that in there. They've got insufficient logging and monitoring, which I think is a good thing to see. See on the list, because it's a thing that is important. They've made room by, I guess, kind of compressing a couple of the other findings together in one. The ones that have fallen off are cross-site request forgery, which is actually still a thing, and unvalidated redirects and forwards, which, you know, I might argue is underrated, but, you know, something's got to go to make room for the others. So, yeah, overall, I'm pretty happy with the list, and it'll do until the next one.
Well, I mean, they seem to be arguing that cross-site request forgery, it's only present in fewer than 5%, of their data set sort of thing. And I'm not sure whether their data set is how often it's attacked or how often it's present. I think it's how often it's present. And unvalidated redirects and forwards, like, has sort of dropped off because it's only 1% of the data set. So there is some method to their madness.
Yeah. I guess I don't disagree. I mean, I think it is, given how much stuff has been owned with deserialization and how widespread bad XML handling is, I do think it's useful to see them in that list. And I don't begrudge them throwing those two out. I mean, I would rather they throw those out than any of the other choices. So, yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. So that's your long way of saying you agree with them. Good job, OWASP.
Yeah. Could have a more brief news session. Yes, I agree. Move on.
So contrary, Adam. So contrary. but it's why we love you. SecureDrop dealing with a pretty bad bug, which is, not what you want in something that's sort of designed to stop whistleblowers being sent to prison or tortured or whatever, you know? You don't want bugs in that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, SecureDrop is the software used by a bunch of media organizations, New York Times, etc., to handle that kind of anonymous dropping. So, yeah, it is important that they get it right. And they've done, I think, a pretty good job of handling the bugs. So in this case, the bug was during installation, it would install some packages without validating the signatures of the Debian packages it was installing, which, you know, clearly is not desirable. And if you were in the middle of the HTTP connection, because it was done over HTTP, which it was in this case, you could substitute, you know, malicious software into the packages. Obviously, an attacker would have to be on the wire between the install and the upstream.
Was it HTTP via just normal web, or was it HTTP via Tor? Because if it was the latter, damn, man, you just spring up a few exit nodes.
This was actually like whilst it was installing the Tor package, so pre-Tor being up. So, yeah, it was in the clear. On one hand, really good that they spotted it and they made a relatively big song and dance, and people are, you know, rebuilding their boxes, which is great. On the other hand, the upstream Debian project doesn't put that much effort into securing the software that you're installing, securing and checking the signatures on. So, big picture, you know, I feel that, like,
big picture, everything is horrible, Adam. We know this. We know this. That's why we have this podcast.
Yes.
You mean that fixing SecureDrop isn't going to fix the world's software supply chain? No way.
Well, yeah. I guess that's what I'm saying. Like big news, right?
Yeah. All right, this is an interesting one that I thought I'd pull out and include, mostly just for people who are involved in collecting vulnerability data, people who have to stay on top of that. Turns out China is doing a much better job than the US the China National Vulnerability Database, the CNNVD, is doing a better job than the NVD in terms of getting bugs into their database quicker, which I just thought, well, hey, if you're the sort of person who has to pay attention to these feeds, this is one you might want to look at.
Yeah, no, it is interesting to see that they were like twice the speed of getting data into their data set, which is great. I mean, but obviously quality of the data does kind of matter more than speed in this case. Although that said, I guess...
Well, it depends on the application, man. Sometimes it's going to be quite handy getting a bit more lead time, you know. You might not outrun the lion, but you might, you know, as the saying goes, but you might outrun the person next to you.
That's true, I guess. Although on the other hand, like I've never found those data sets super useful. Maybe I'm not the target audience.
That's because you're a pen tester, you know. Like, I know people who do find this data useful, especially people who have to manage, you know, large networks with lots of different devices on them. I mean, it's handy stuff. And there's also a lot of solutions and, you know, automation and scripting that takes NVD feeds, right? So, you know, if you could actually take a CNNVD feed, you might find that you'll be able to accelerate some aspects of your program. But you're right. I mean, I've got no idea what the quality of the data is like. Joseph Cox has a great story here for the Daily Beast, just about this dark web, like phishing guy, calls himself Fish Kings, who got himself doxxed. And, you know, I mean, big deal, right? But the funny thing is how this person got doxxed. And it was really because someone managed to grab a hash of a password the guy had used when he took over a site, because he owned up this other site and was bragging about how he took it over. Someone else then re-owned that site, grabbed his password, cracked it, and then went through dumps looking for people who used the same password, and then bang, got him out of a public dump, happy days, doxxed, and the guy's just like, you know, done internet seppuku.
Yeah, no, it's a smooth technique. Nicely done there by Mr. Insanity DRM. Apparently it was the guy who doxxed him. Yeah, like smooth technique. Apparently the password was like a football club with a number on the end. So I'm glad to see that, you know, even underground criminals have the same standards of passwords as everyone's corporates. So, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting seeing what people are doing with password hashes. Like Alex, the hacker known as Alex, had an interesting blog post up on his Tumblr a while back about owning a friend with her permission. And one of the things that he tried, in this case it didn't actually work, but it was just a good idea, is he had a salted hashed password that he couldn't crack from his target. So then he just looked for other instances of that salted hashed password in the same dump, and then grabbed the username, a different username that happened to use the same password, and then searched that username in other dumps, and then just found a straight SHA hashed password, cracked that, and then boom, actually recovered the password. So you can do a lot with them, I guess is what I'm saying. Even when you can't recover a password because it's a, you know, salted hash, you because they were using the same salt, don't ask me why, in this data set, but yeah, in some cases, when you can't recover someone's password, you might be able to just find where someone else has used the same password and then, you know, onwards from there, right? So there are some non-obvious uses for this sort of data.
Yeah, no, that's that is a really good story. I mean, A, it illustrates, good lateral thinking for a hacker, which is an important thing to have, and B, illustrates why exactly you're supposed to salt things and why you're supposed to use a different salt every time.
Yeah, but they don't. But you know, even if someone was using unsalted bcrypt, that technique would work really well, right? So when you're always going to get the same result from the, you know, password hashing process, when there's no salt involved or a static salt, then you can actually use that technique. So that, I thought that was pretty cool. I'll put a link into Alex's Tumblr in this week's show so people can check that out. Now this group, the Dark Overlord, this is the group that had was extorting Netflix and then moved on to extorting schools. I think we spoke about that recently, but I cut it for space. They're just kind of giant internet jerks. They've now broken into a London-based plastic surgeons' systems and stolen a whole bunch of photos. Like, and we're talking about stuff like, you know, surgery on famous people's, like, you know, private bits. And I just sort of think, wow, you guys are kind of horrible people, eh?
Yeah, like I've seen some nasty people do a lot of nasty things on the internet. And this is just a level of nasty that's beyond...
It's 24 karat rolled gold nasty. Like, it's proper nasty, isn't it?
Yeah, and they apparently got in touch with Joseph Cox and were like sending him pictures of like people's mid-operation genitals and stuff. Like, that's just messed up, you know, messed up. And they claim they got terabytes of this stuff. And their MO has traditionally been to try and extort people, and then if that doesn't work, you know, go dumping it around the internet, and they're threatening to dump all of this data, which. Like, how do you even sleep at night being this kind of person? Like, I don't
know. I think being 14 years old would help because that's what this reeks of to me.
Yeah, it kind of does, eh? Yeah.
It does.
Well, and I guess it illustrates that, you know, if you are a medical provider, like, quite how much you have to take this seriously. Like, you actually do really, you have an obligation to do a good job of protecting your data. Like a really actually good job.
Yeah, and apparently this surgery, you know, it's really one for the rich and famous, including royals and all that sort of stuff. And it's just like, man, that's pretty rough. We're going to finish the news, Adam, with a bit of a chuckle this week. The DHS, the Department of Homeland Security in the United States, has, pushed out a bunch of IOCs for, like, the Dragonfly APT. But apparently, like, all of their rules are, like, kind of and just triggering on all sorts of stuff. So yay, well done DHS.
Yeah, apparently they put out some rules, and amongst other things included, like, hashes of signed PSExec binaries from Microsoft and stuff, which, I mean, okay, if you don't use PSExec in your environment, maybe that would be useful. But presumably you already have all of the hashes of all the PSExecs that you'd be looking for if that was the case. But yeah, like, really not helpful, and just goes to show that, you know, blindly ingesting
Yara rules from the Department of Homeland Security.
IOC feeds is just not. It really does take some human intervention, which people don't want to deal with. The fact that actual human attackers do need human defenders, and you can't just throw automation at it and pretend it's going to be fine.
Yeah, but I think that's where we need to go. You know, like, we don't expect. You know, people don't expect that they throw automation at stuff and everything's fine. They throw automation at stuff and hope that it helps. This is a pretty bad thing for them to have done, because it's turned from a time saver into a time drainer, and that's bad. But just boneheaded, you'd think they'd do a bit more testing.
Well, yeah, but then again, I guess writing Yara rules is not a particularly glamorous or highly paid job, and probably it just gets lumped off onto whatever, you know, intern or newbie, and this is what happens. I mean, it's a thing you have to spend real money and have, you know, proper, focused, good quality work on.
Well, mate, that's actually it for the week's news, but did you notice something awesome about this week's news?
It was short and did not have horribly complicated stories in it.
I was going to say, we didn't spend much time on talking about geopolitics and the North Koreans and the this and the that. We actually just got to speak about some bread and butter InfoSec this week. Wasn't that nice?
Actually, that is quite nice. Yeah, it's a little bit more relaxing than talking about what Kim Jong-un's up to these days.
That's right. All right, mate. Well, thanks a lot for that. It's been a lot of fun, and I'll chat to you again next week.
I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news headlines. It is time for this week's feature interview now with Matt Tate. Matt is an ex-GCHQ dude who's currently in the USA teaching at the University of Texas, Austin. His course is for law students and people destined for careers in public policy. And he's teaching them all about information security, and the course is actually a pretty technical one. The idea being that he can equip these soon-to-be important people with the knowledge they'll require to make good decisions when it comes to InfoSec policy, or policy that, you know, touches InfoSec. Matt's also been in the news himself. He was apparently approached during last year's US election campaign by someone claiming to be associated with with Team Trump, and he was asked to verify a trove of Hillary Clinton's emails that were supposedly obtained by Russian hackers or something along those lines. It's just one more weird data point in the whole Russia thing. Now, I have no idea if Matt's role in this thing is actually that important, but either way, if I were him, I would be avoiding polonium sushi, that's for sure. We're not talking to Matt about that this week. We're talking to him about Kaspersky. As all Risky Business listeners no doubt know, Kaspersky has been accused of operating as an extension of Russia's signals intelligence services. The most extreme allegations say Kaspersky antivirus was configured by the company to search users' hard drives for key terms like top secret, which, if true, would be very, very bad. But there is a counter-narrative here. What if Kaspersky was just searching for terms associated with NSA tooling and exfiltrating information from boxes where they got hits? You know, how would that be any different from Symantec researchers liberating some sensitive material from a Chinese APT crew? Now, surely it would be reasonable to steal NSA tooling so you could create signatures to detect it. Furthermore, sharing that information with Russian intelligence would be pretty reasonable, you would think, in that case, if you're viewing the NSA as any other APT crew. Then, in that case, that narrative vindicates Kaspersky somewhat. But again, the more extreme allegations say they were looking for stuff beyond malware information. And they weren't doing this to create signatures. That's what the allegations say. They were doing it for the sole purpose of providing intelligence to the Russian government. So there we go. Two competing narratives based mostly on leaks and counterclaims. And they're both quite plausible. Matt Tate joined me to talk through some of the Kaspersky allegations. But most importantly, he's along this week to argue strongly that the US government should just go public with its assessment. Not its evidence, just its assessment. You'll also hear Matt and I talk about social media disinformation and a couple of other topics, but here's Matt.
So I think that it would be very dangerous for Kaspersky to start putting in signatures in their products for things that clearly have nothing at all to do with cybersecurity. So in the event that they're looking for, you know, keyword matches on something like top secret or secret or specific things like that, it would essentially Kaspersky and all antivirus companies have to provide databases to their software that is published to all computers. And that database is what the antivirus product on your computer is looking through to look for. That is where all of its signatures are. And people go through those databases and they reverse engineer them because there's actually a pretty active market in signature piracy in the antivirus community, where, you know, one antivirus company will reverse engineer the signatures of another antivirus company in order to include them in their own product. So it seems to me like this would be a really risky strategy for a company like Kaspersky, because in the event that your computer is now starting to search your files for top secret, then someone else might reverse engineer and discover that it's doing that. And at that point, Kaspersky's reputation is completely toast.
Would it be possible, though, to obfuscate those signatures so that what they're doing is not immediately obvious to someone who's reverse engineering them?
So that's one of the things that they already do in order to try and prevent this piracy that goes on. I think what's perhaps more likely is that you end up with something along the lines of an over-collection on the front end and then looking for these sort of more sensitive signatures at the back end. So, for instance, you might say, in the event that we discover some particular signatures that we can look for sort of blanketly, where it might be deniable whether or not we're looking at these for foreign intelligence purposes or for cybersecurity purposes, and we're just going to hoover up all of these documents once we discover it.
Or yeah, discover so like they detect a bit of flame or Dooku on someone's box and they say, grab all Microsoft Word documents.
Yes, precisely. So, you know, I could completely imagine that they would say, you know, we discovered someone plugged in a USB stick and one of the things on the USB stick triggered for, you know, NSA malware. So we're going to hoover up everything on the USB stick. And then, you know, they can then make a very strong claim that this is for cybersecurity reasons, not for foreign intelligence reasons. But then, of course, they have a whole bunch of files on a Kaspersky software, on a Kaspersky server somewhere. And then Russian intelligence might come along and say, well, you know, give us access to those, or we're going to search with these terms on things that have been uploaded to Kaspersky, so that you might get sort of intelligence on the back end searches rather than on front end searches, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. But I mean, you know, this conversation is operating under the assumption that the story is, you know, by and large true. Is that what you believe as well?
It's very hard to parse at the moment because there's so many different allegations that are sort of going around. Some of them, they don't sound like they're coming from inside the intelligence community. They sound like they're coming from people that have got second and third and fourth hand information. And, you know, certainly in Congress, there's been a lot of people that have been making allegations against Kaspersky for a long time. It's difficult to work out how grounded these claims are. There was one story, the Wall Street Journal story in particular, suggested that there was a document written for the National Security Council, which suggested that this might have taken place. But we're still operating with, you know, large numbers of leaks. There's no official claim one way or the other. I actually think that that's a real problem, that if Kaspersky is acting on behalf of the Russian government, I think the US government should, you know, be brave enough to you know, put an official stamp on it and say it out loud.
Well, I sort of wonder what's in it for them, right? Because clearly just running some leaks has had the desired effect. So why would you then actually do any more? I mean, you know, declassifying stuff, I'm sure you know, is very difficult, very time-consuming and requires political will. So I'm not holding my breath, I guess is what I'm saying.
Sure. I mean, I'm not convinced that they need to declassify why they think it's the case. I just think that they ought to say it out loud that they do think it's the case, because the, you know, U.S. national security not only relies on federal systems, it relies on state systems, it relies on defense companies, it relies on foreign government systems and foreign defense company systems as well. And in the event that you, the United States, say this is a dangerous product, then actually that gives an incentive for all of those companies and all of those countries to be able to say, well, actually, okay, we need to remove this from our networks. Mm. And so if that is the case, I think that there is a benefit in them just making it an official statement. They don't need to say why they think it, but I do think they need to make it an official statement.
You sound a little more skeptical than I would have expected.
I suppose it's because I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley during the Snowden leaks, and I remember seeing a very large number of incredibly spurious articles about what Silicon Valley was or wasn't doing, and sort of having the inside information from the US side as to exactly, you know, what, you know, all of these claims that were just completely fabricated.
Man, the Prism stuff was probably the most hilarious, would you say? I mean, if you had to rank them in, you know, orders from most hilarious to least hilarious.
It's a difficult thing for me to make a list of, but there was a lot of stories where it was just completely bogus information. And working with people in Silicon Valley who, you know, understood exactly how these systems worked, they would say, you know, it's just made up. And so it's right that there's a lot of smoke here with Kaspersky and not much fire. But then, you know, I remember it when, you know, the shoe was on the other foot, and remembering how, you know, the rhetoric was quite decoupled from reality.
Mm. But the comments have come from so many different places. I mean, we even had Rob Joyce, who's the White House security coordinator, former head of TAO. He was one of the most strident voices saying, don't use Kaspersky. And he strikes me as a pretty reasonable fellow.
Oh, for sure. And I think that there's a bunch of quite credible people saying that there are things that are wrong here. But I think that they ought to put a US government seal of approval on that statement.
Mm. And you don't think that'd require PCAPs? I mean, that's one thing, actually. Haroon Mir was recently saying that, you know, the Snowden thing did damage the US government's and, you know, particularly the intelligence community's relationship with the technology sector. And this would be a really good time for them to try to rebuild that trust by showing us what they've got. I mean, there was one part of one of the stories about Kaspersky where they were saying that, you know, they loaded a computer with a bunch of documents to see what Kaspersky antivirus did. And based on the results of those experiments, it sort of confirmed to them that it was being used for signals, you know, signal intelligence collection, right? There would be, I mean, given that you're just observing something that a antivirus tool is doing, you would think that you could declassify that evidence pretty easily and not be giving away any sort of sensitive tools. It's a straight up normal experiment that anyone would be able to do.
I suppose it depends on things like, you know, for instance, did they load those documents with, you know, classified, you know, terms that they expected Kaspersky to trigger on? And then getting people to reproduce that might require you to, you know, say what the classified terms are.
I'm not saying they need to reproduce it. I mean, they can redact the actual terms, but actually outlining in detail what the experiment was and maybe showing some redacted packet captures or something. I mean, that'd go a long way, you would think.
Potentially. I mean, I tend to take the view that you can't produce evidence in order to persuade people of things in this type of domain. I think we've seen this sort of time and time again, that every time that you release evidence, there's going to be naysayers who are going to, you know, try and find reasons why this particular piece of evidence isn't sufficiently good enough and why you should always release more.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's
the jet fuel can't melt steel beams thing, I think, is what you're talking about.
Exactly. And I don't think that there's any amount of evidence that you'll be able to produce that will ever be able to persuade, everybody. But I do think that there's a real difference between, you know, credible people inside the US government have said X versus the United States government has said X, especially when it comes to if you're a foreign defense company or if you're a foreign government. You know, there's a big difference between Rob Joyce, who works at the White House, said this versus the United States government has alerted you to this.
So where would you like to see this warning come from?
So in much the same way that we had, for instance, the October IC assessment for last year, where the US government said, everybody knows that this was Russia, but we're now putting an official stamp on the, you know, the IC says with high confidence, this is Russian intelligence that's behind this. I would like something along those types of lines where you say, you know, there's all of these allegations out there that Kaspersky is doing this on behalf of the Russian government. The IC believes or doesn't believe this, and with what confidence? I think that would go a long way.
Yeah, look, it would put an end to the nonstop, you know, carnival of leaks, and maybe give us some clarity. So I think that's a reasonable ask. Now, look, Matt, one of the things that you've been doing is working for the University of Texas Austin. You are teaching, you are teaching law students and people who are destined for careers in public policy, and indeed people who are already in public policy. You've been teaching them about information security in a technical course. You know, which I imagine is a challenging and also very interesting job. But I wanted to ask you, what's your opinion of how well-equipped policymakers are these days in terms of making decisions around this stuff? Because it seems to me that we've come a long way, particularly in the last few years. And these days, when I hear policymakers talking about security-related concepts, they seem to be well-briefed. Is that am I off base there, or is it are things actually getting better?
So I think it's a mixed bag still. I think it is better than it used to be. And I think it still varies quite widely by country and by, you know, individual. Mm. But it's definitely been the case where, for instance, with law enforcement and senior people inside the intelligence community, I've definitely started to see them. They have a better understanding of technology. That's not to say that they understand it well, but they understand that it's important. They are clearly getting briefed on aspects of it that matter, and there certainly in the US I've seen that there's a better appreciation that this is an important topic, and getting staffers to be trained on it so that they can write, you know, more sensible legislation, if not necessarily, you know, perfect legislation. And we've definitely seen this with, for instance, policymakers getting very concerned over things like social media, you know, getting concerned over things like, you know, posting of terrorist content and whether or not that should be removed or whether it shouldn't be removed. You're getting much more discussions over things like adverts, especially in the context of things like whether or not Russia was buying ads. So you're starting to see that technology is now a much bigger part of everyday policy discussions. And so I think they're being forced by necessity to understand it a little bit better.
Mm. It's interesting what you say too, because, you know, we had planned to speak a little bit about this new push into propaganda and, you know, manipulation of the agenda through social media shenanigans. I thought Alex Damas' talk at Black Hat was very interesting. I'm not sure if you saw that, if you were there or if you watched the video, but he was really saying that that site abuse and this sort of stuff really falls on information security people, because they're the ones who are best equipped to deal with an adversarial situation. Do you think that this is something the InfoSec industry really needs to jump into as well, which is to really start coming up with some solutions to these abuse issues that are doing stuff like pushing propaganda?
So definitely I think the technology community does. And whether you're going to lump that in with InfoSec or technology more sort of generally, I don't know the answer to that one. But certainly I think we've got to a point now where technology companies have very, very broad say over public forums that everybody is now used to. You know, the way that we interact with the world now is extremely digital and extremely controlled by the small number of companies in Silicon Valley. And that makes it much harder for technologists to say, we're just writing cool code and seeing what works, right? They actually now have a dramatic impact on the way that we interact with each other, the way that we interact with the government, the way that we interact with the world around us. And I think it's sort of, it's by necessity, they now need to start thinking about what are the social consequences of some of those things.
See, one thing that occurs to me, Matt, sorry to cut your flow there, but one thing that occurs to me is the canary in the coal mine for all of this stuff with things like the anti-vaccination movement, the Truther movement, and David Avocado Wolf. Right? I mean, Facebook was totally happy to sit back and let disinformation spread on its network when it was of that sort of more benign type. Not that I think that anti-vaccination is the anti-vaccination movement is benign. But you see what I mean, right? It was like this was allowed to fester for a while, and the only reason people give a shit now is because they feel that it had an impact on the United States election last year.
So I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And basically what it comes down to is it comes down to there's a series of really weird, perverse incentives that essentially mean through nobody sort of, you know, wants disinformation, but the way that the incentives are structured makes that the sort of the popular or sort of highly incentivized form of how we interact with social media. Because in the event that you are a technology company, if you're Twitter, if you're Facebook, the way that you are making money is through adverts. And the reason that adverts are making you money is because people are clicking on them.
Which and you means need that stuff you need- to go viral, right? I mean, I wrote a bit of a Twitter thread on this. And, you know, the idea is because Facebook only shows you stuff that you like and doesn't really care if it's true or not because it's all user shared content, really it's in their best interests for as much stuff to be liked, shared, and clicked on as humanly possible. Thus, it's in the interests of the people who are writing that content to make it as clickbaity as possible. And quite often they'll just make it up because it does better. And I do feel that we've all not seen the risk, right? When it was just people talking about how marijuana cures cancer, it didn't seem like such a big deal. And now that it's, you know, Hillary Clinton's a HIV positive robot from Mars, it's, you know, now we're like, oh, this maybe we shouldn't have let this run.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental problem is that from Facebook or from Twitter's perspective, a click is a click. And they honestly don't care whether or not you are clicking and engaging with content that is true and is, you know, providing you with useful information that's going to make you a better citizen, or whether you are interacting with information that is dreadful and actually going to encourage, you know, our worst human habits of confirmation bias. And confirmation bias is this thing that really strongly drives us towards the sort of ideological extremes. And it's sort of a self-reinforcing vicious cycle, right? Where, you know, you sort of start slightly right of center, and then you're going to end up with, you know, more and more, you know, adverts around, more and more suggested followers and so on, where they're suggesting it, you know, to make you feel more comfortable and to drive up your engagement.
Well, this is the thing. You select your own worldview right now, right? Like there's custom-made worldviews for everyone. You can follow a whole suite of media companies that will just give you stuff that you're comfortable with, whether you're a rabid conservative, a rabid lefty, whether or not you're someone who's, you know, conspiratorially minded, right? Believe in a lot of conspiracy theories. That's, you know, it's all there and you can choose it, right? And it's this constantly reinforcing thing. And I just sort of worry that we're already a little bit too far down the path to turn it back. I think deprogramming someone who, you know, really believes in these funny ideas, these funny contemporary ideas, and they get their worldview from Facebook. I mean, deprogramming them, I would imagine, is as hard as deprogramming someone from Islamic State.
Yeah, I mean, we've essentially built, you know, Silicon Valley on these platforms that are optimized, hyper-optimized for self-radicalization. And now we're discovering, hey, actually, maybe that wasn't so great.
Yeah. Now, of course, too, Matt, you would be paying more attention than most people to these types of issues, mostly because they surround the whole, you know, Russia investigation and Russia controversy. You yourself are caught up in this. I believe you were recently interviewed by the special prosecutor's team. Is there anything you can tell me about what's going on in regard to your role in this whole mess right now?
Without confirming or denying any of what you just said, I honestly can't talk about it, which is a real shame. I would love to talk about it, but unfortunately I can't.
All right, Matt Tate, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about a mixed bag of topics. It's always great to have you, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
That was Matt Tate there. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Chris Coulter of Cylance. Cylance, spelled C-Y-L-A-N-C-E, is of course the maker of machine learning-backed AV that people tell me works very well. The funny thing is the market really has moved in the last few years, and it's easy to look at Cylance as just another AV firm. But honestly, people have forgotten what things were like before these guys came along. They were the first of the so-called next-generation AV companies. They used machine learning to create something new, really, and they were able to seize a chunk of the market that previously belonged to the incumbent companies like Symantec and McAfee. The overall effect of Silence has been actually very positive for the endpoint security space, not just because they made something new, but because they were the first company to meaningfully challenge the incumbents and thus make it possible for new entrants to come in after them. Not only that, but we've seen the incumbents themselves actually lift their game in a meaningful way in the last few years. As best I can tell, they're all using some form of machine learning now, you know, to various degrees, and they're really focusing hard on building more lightweight stuff that's easier to manage. So in other words, Silence gave the AV industry the kick in the pants it absolutely deserved. And I'm saying this as a way to set context for this interview, because Silence is now working very hard on a few things outside of AV. One of those things is endpoint detection and response, and they call that Silence Optics. Their version one, to be frank, was a bit of a disappointment, but they've already bounced back with a second version that's showing a lot more promise. But they're really ramping it up now, and I think we can expect to see some meaningful new versions dropping as soon as December this year. I'm hoping, and I'm hopeful, that Silence's upcoming releases in the EDR space could give the wider endpoint security market a similar kick in the pants to the one they delivered with their AV solution. Chris Coulter has been around incident response for a decade, the last five of those years spent at Silence. He recently moved to the product development side, and he joined me via Skype to talk about incident response and how it's informing the development of EDR products. He started off by telling me about the two things that were at the root of most of the incidents he investigated and still are at the root of most incidents that occur. Here's Chris.
The larger an organization, you know, they have lots of systems and they have lots of projects that are going on. People come and go. They just forget about their assets. They'll leave a Server 2003 device unpatched, you know, just sitting out there that they've forgotten about. So I guess it kind of goes back to the just basic hygiene and asset management. And then the second one is still just user education. I mean, phishing emails are still really, really successful. None of that has changed, even with all the media. So just about every single breach, I mean, we can trace back to those two simple avenues. I mean, that is the formula. Mm. Either find that they've forgotten about, and then from there, you know, the bad guys are going to somehow want to remain persistent. So if they do close that avenue, they'll have it. Or in spear phishing, they'll just play the numbers or go really targeted.
Yeah, well, I mean, even if it's not a completely forgotten about asset, just asset tracking is hard, as we discovered with the Equifax thing where, you know, I fired up the microphone and I'm like, how did they not know? This is insane. They're incompetent. And then got deluged with emails from, you know, recently appointed CISOs who've gone in and confronted all this legacy crap and realized that there's no way to even know something as basic as what framework their development team used to create their primary web application. So, yeah, I mean, asset management, I can absolutely see as being a horror show.
Yep, and it was all resting on one guy, apparently, right?
Yeah, which is probably not the best, approach. But that is a hard problem, as is the user education problem. So you would go in and do a lot of these, IR gigs. You've worked at everywhere from PwC to the IRS. You've done all sorts of jobs. How did you actually speed up your IR? I understand you actually wound up, you know, just hacking together a bunch of tools for very specific purposes. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, when you do something repetitively like that, somebody who's a pen tester, you know, I have great respect for those pen testers because I don't know how to do half of the stuff that they're able to do. And, you know, maybe likewise for incident responders, they're, pen testers looking at us like, how do you guys do that? And it's really pretty simple. It's just, you kind of have to have the experience to see it enough. And then that's it. It's, you know, there's kind of a limited, bag of tricks and, tradecraft. And it's, you can automate almost all of that in some way. And then that enables pretty much anyone to become an incident responder, which is why I think around 2013, you saw kind of the rise of EDR as an actual like coinable, you know, commercial based offering. Basically just takes all the tradecraft and, thought out of incident response and puts it into a nice little GUI that you can point and click and, anyone can become an incident responder at that point.
Yeah, well, I think, Mandiant was really the first one to do that successfully, right? I mean, they were certainly leading the charge back then.
Yep. Their solution, really allowed them to still be, incident responders and go crazy. They didn't simplify too much. They facilitated access to do pretty much anything because they were dealing with, you know, just really sophisticated attacks. And sometimes they needed to get into the memory level. Sometimes they needed to just, you know, run Yara sweeps across their entire environment. So they needed a tool that really just, you know, almost think of it as a full-blown reverse shell to entire organizations.
Mm. Which is funny, right? Because that's the feedback I get, is that it was really a pro tool. And so when FireEye acquired them and they're like, hey, here's our awesome IR, you know, IR made easy tool, people were like, what? it was not the most user-friendly thing in the world for people who weren't experts.
Yep, exactly. And then I think, you know, it borders on the line of, you know, there's a reason why Encase Enterprise and, you know, F-Response and FTK, why those aren't considered EDR tools. It just, you need training behind it. You need a lot of experience. It's not something you can just pick up, deploy, and run. You still have to be some sort of practitioner to run those. I think, yeah, those tools fit into that area, whereas maybe a Carbon Black and, you know, Silence Optics and, you know, all the other players in that EDR space, there's a lot of capability there that doesn't exist in those tools versus the others.
It's interesting, right? Because you have had this long career in incident response, and now you've joined the product side to build up Silence's, you know, optics product. So, you know, I understand there's a version out there, but you're basically, you know, recreating a much more fully featured product. Like, it's almost like a greenfields development. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah. We had version one about a year and some change ago, and we scrapped that and completely rebuilt it about 8 or 9 months ago. So we're starting, you know, I don't want to say fresh, but we basically tried for the first time. I think we had the scope a little bit off. Version two came out, and definitely it has an architecture that allows us to rapidly add a lot of interesting features to kind of adjust as the market starts to, I guess, more appropriately define what EDR should be how it.
Now, that's the interesting part of the conversation, right? And I think it's interesting that people like you who've had 10 years in experience actually doing incident response are now the ones who are creating incident response tools, because that sort of, you know, that makes a bit of sense, right? For sort of mainstream enterprise security products. But, you know, we were just talking and you know, over your 10 years doing this stuff, you know, most of what you were doing in terms of automating your work was just hacking together things like bash scripts, right?
Yes and no. I mean, the first thing is, you know, there's really two components. There's always going to be a need to kind of look back and say, all right, hey, has this indicator been there? Or, you know, you have to know something to use that part, right? Where, however you know about that, right? There's some sort of tip off. And, you know, in the past, we would get called in because our FBI, you know, alerted the client and they learned of the breach. Or, you know, maybe they realized that, hey, a phishing email went around. Well, let's see who else has that. So that kind of, you know, point in time, you know, looking back, indicator search, that's really kind of based around just aggregating information. The second part is, you know, well, if you don't know something, how do you, you know, then what do you do? And that's where I think, you know, we've had SEMS and other analytical devices where they try to just piece together things to build anomalies and alert you on that. That field is still out there. But what we're taking is a little bit different shift where it would be, we call it our context analysis engine, where it's actually, you know, tapping into that same sensor that records data, but doing so in a way that, you know, tries to peel out context. So, you know, hey, it's aggregating all that data live on the endpoint and saying, you know, whatever the context is this malicious or not? And then you're able to take a response rule to it. So really what that does is just gives you, you know, think of them as tripwires, or it's alerting you to something. So now you don't have to know about it. And then you can take a response to it. And if you still need to do the incident response, you know, all the right features are there to kind of hunt the trail and follow the breadcrumbs. There's, you know, sort of a problem with that, because to define those rules, you still have to know something, which, you know, is always evolving.
But I mean, you know, obviously, you know, you guys are huge into machine learning, and, you know, machine setting context is basically what machine learning is for, right?
And there you go. Yeah. So our version, you know, 2.1 is, you know, I don't want to bluntly say this, but it is essentially static rules. That's A plus B, you know, equals whatever. And so, you know, we've kind of leveraged, you know, our research and, you know, the community's research on what we know to be attack vectors. And we've written rules for those but those will, you know, those won't be relevant tomorrow. So that's why we are introducing machine learning, artificial intelligence into that to help augment those static rules. And I think that's
I'm really glad to hear you use that terminology of augmentation, right? Because that's what, when I think of machine learning, I don't think of it as this amazing cure-all that's just going to help to knock attacks on its head. But I can remember spending some time in front of an IDS console back in the day, right? And most of that work could have been handled by machine learning. I mean, even tuning just gets you a long way, right? But if you start actually using a bit of a helper, I try to think of machine learning as like, a helper agent, right? Is that the best way to think of it? Because I think people do get a little bit carried away with it.
Yep, exactly. So actually a good, a good example of, you know, why we know this will work, but it to your point, yes, augmentation. A lot of companies do this. They'll call them compromise assessments or breach assessments. Silence does these all day long. And you just go out, you collect all this data and you look at it offline and you try to piece together stuff. It's really painstakingly, it's eye bleeding to try to find the bad stuff. We do almost always find bad stuff, as do other vendors. But it wasn't until, one of our colleagues actually just said, well, hey, let's try just putting an ML rule on this. And he applied it to trying to find a compromised account based on just event logs and file directory information. So C users, and then, you know, you have your profile and then everything in there. And he ran this on a real breach, didn't know anything about the breach. We had already finished it, ran it across all the data. And within out of 70,000+ users, it popped out the two users that were actually compromised. So we were like, holy cow, this actually could work. Like, you know, this is really fun. And then of course, from there, now you got your starting point. That's something, you know. And there was still a lot more to piece together that I don't think ML could do, but.
But the point is, you've just saved yourself a buttload of time. I mean, how many of the major vendors in the EDR space are actually pushing down the ML route? I'm curious about that. Because, you know, for Silence, it's always been pretty core to Silence's marketing, you know, and to its early successes. And I just sort of wonder, is this something that, you know, you're expected to apply machine learning to whatever problem because you've sort of positioned yourselves as a machine learning company. But is this something that the others like CrowdStrike, Carbon Black, you know, FireEye, is this something they're doing as well?
I don't know the extent. I think everyone's going to, you know, try to claim ML or of some sort, you know, at least kind of reading some of the analyst predictions, you know, like Gartner and IDC and all those, Forrester, you know, they're all predicting that everybody will be doing that soon. I don't know yet today if, you know, they're using true ML. I honestly just don't know. I think they're claiming it, or they're claiming it soon will be.
So when are you planning on introducing the, you know, sort of machine learning component to the EDR bit?
We're hoping to have kind of our first release of this right around December time period, give or take. And we'll probably, you know, roll it out a little bit lightly first. We'll want to have it, be kind of categorized into certain scopes. So, you know, maybe use AI to detect lateral movement or command and control or, you know, persistence or, you know, well, we'll kind of tie it to a scope for now just to start to measure the efficacy and, you know, see how it actually works. And then, you know, I think the long-term goal is really to get to, a global question of, is there something good or bad, without trying to, you know, box it into those types of categories.
It's so interesting. Are you actually planning on doing anything in UBA? Because that's one area where I've seen machine learning applied that just is, you know, it's very effective.
Yes. So we do have another... side project. I don't know if I can mention it fully, but yes, there is.
Yes, but shut up.
Yeah. The backbone of optics, Silence Optics, is, you know, if you have that kernel level sensor, you can pretty much do anything with it. And then, you know, our data scientists are, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, here's another use case. Here's another one. So yes, I think that is on the roadmap.
All right, Chris Coulter, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk us through the ins and outs of, you know, what's really happening in sort of EDR development and product roadmaps. It's very interesting.
Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
That was Chris Coulter of Silence there. Silence makes a great machine learning-based AV solution, Silence Protect. And as you just heard, they have some huge plans in the EDR space. I will be watching that closely. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.